Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today I'm looking at The Hill, and The Hill, TheHill.com has got a story about the Amazon election that went exactly the way I had predicted it was going to go. I did have some guarded optimism, as I said all along, since Joe Biden did jump into it, and there was so much attention on how horrible Amazon was doing things. We were highlighting what's been the reality for decades. So I had some hope that it'd be closer. But now you've got The Hill coming out saying, well, you know, the labor advocates are floating new strategies. And I thought, well, the new strategy should be changing our laws, because we definitely need to do something on the legal front. And also doing much more as organizers to make sure that there's a union culture. And I thought it'd be a good opportunity to talk about what happened in Alabama and maybe how things go forward. And one of the guys who I think is one of the top organizers in the country and a good friend of the show, I've asked Sean Rickman to come talk with us. He's the program director of the Harry Van Ardsdale Junior School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College. He's also written the book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Sean, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm not active duty, though, although I'm like really eager to get back into it with everything that I've seen at Amazon. I'm just fascinated. I want to get, you know, I want to get in a car and talk to some workers, like old school, you know, once all the vaccines are in everybody's arms and, you know, in the future when all is well.
Yeah, I mean, you're one of those guys I look to for advice and when you're talking about organizing, because you've done this stuff, you know it. So in looking at what happened in Alabama, you know, given the realities of COVID and given the realities that you're dealing with a global behemoth, give me your assessment of what went wrong.
I mean, I'm with you in that, like, I was also sort of cautiously optimistic. I mean, the union was definitely sort of taking a risk. I think they were taking a risk that their organizing committee understood. You know, I mean, and what they did is they created sort of Exhibit A of how broken our labor laws are. And in doing that, they did everybody, every worker around the country, a big favor. In a lot of respects, this is, you know, Back to the Future again, you know, Little Steel in the late 1930s, who just absolutely resisted what was on the books as laws in terms of workers' rights, and got very powerful senators and Congress members holding hearings to investigate just how badly these major corporations thumbed their noses at the law. I'm sort of taken, and again, I'm 5 years out of active duty as a union organizer. There's two major questions that this campaign raises for me that I hope that more people that are thoughtful about engaging with, you know, what do we do? What is to be done? Engage with, and in the what we call the organizing model, which is in my mind, it's based off of a lot of research that Dr. Kate Bronfenbrenner did in the 1980s and the 1990s, of sort of scientifically measuring effective union organizing tactics, and also sort of countermeasuring boss tactics, captive audience meetings, you know, pasting a "you don't have to vote for the union" thing on the door of the toilet stall that you're taking a dump in.
Yeah, people walking around with sandwich boards saying how bad the union is. You know, paying, or you know, union busters $10,000 a day to come, and because Amazon spent $200 million fighting back this one campaign, I don't think they'd have spent that in several contracts.
No, they wouldn't have. And the campaign messaging was garbage, but that's also actually like a part of the point, right? Like the workers get the message of like, they turn this place upside down. 6 months ago, they were telling us that it's about pack 57 boxes in 53 seconds. And now I'm in this captive audience meeting. We're wasting the entire day on like these nonsense messages of like, oh, you're so concerned about how I'm going to spend a dollar a day in my wages on union dues. Right. And like the message is that's how crazy we are. Yep. We will burn this place down if you defy us. And that is actually very, very effective. So, you know, going back to the organizing model, you know, one of these sort of, you know, two of the sort of unspoken principles of it are that you basically have to organize in secret. That you need a strong organizing committee. You need to have 70% of people on cards or a petition, because the boss is going to be they're going to remind you why you're taking a dump, that we know that you're taking a dump on our dime.
And they did, because they had the little wristbands telling them where you were, and they had the signs in the stalls telling you that.
In the stalls! Yes. In the stalls! Like, you can't take a dump in peace. Like, your boss is telling you, no union.
We know where you are. We now know what you're reading.
We know what you're doing. We know you're doing it while you're on the clock. I mean, that's pretty intimidating. And so one of the unspoken rules of the organizing model, and this was designed in the 1980s, is basically like, nobody cares. The general public, politicians, they're not going to care. They're not going to have any sympathy for a union. They don't care that the boss is breaking the law. And so that's why you have to like lock it down, keep it secret. Don't go public without more than 70% of the vote. You're going to lose that vote. Do the effective tactics, and hopefully you can eke out a victory.
Right.
And the other unspoken rule is that a high-profile loss for one group of workers could have a chilling effect on a whole bunch of other workers. I question how. I mean, this is our perfect opportunity to. I feel like things are changing. On the first hand, the idea that like the general public doesn't care about union busting and that the politicians don't care, I think that's actually effectively out the window. And so one of the things that the workers at Amazon, that the RWDSU did, is they just let Amazon be Amazon in front of a world stage. And everybody's kind of horrified by it. I mean, it's pretty ugly. It's ugly, it's disgusting, it's cheap, it's stupid. And it's just exhibit A for why we need the PRO Act. And on the second point, does this have a chilling effect on organizing? I don't know. This is why I want to get in a car and talk to as many workers as possible. I genuinely don't know. I feel like there's a chance that has also changed. But that's kind of where we're at. You know, I mean, if we do get the PRO Act, we can't have this sort of slavish devotion to, an organizing model that was tested during the Reagan-Bush era. We do need to be a lot more experimental, and if we're actually gonna tell the bosses, if we're gonna win anything, we need a higher degree of worker self-organizing, and that's what this campaign was to a large degree. This was a hot shop. The workers turned to RWDSU under really difficult circumstances. You know, I mean, working in an Amazon fulfillment center is bad on any given day. Working during the pandemic is awful. And the feeling was, well, let's just do it. Let's run it as quickly as possible. And let's let Amazon be Amazon, and let that try to convince more Congress members and senators that we need to change the law, and let's let the workers learn from this and figure out how to run a stronger, harder, hopefully more national campaign the next time around.
No, and that's where my mindset is. When they first filed the petition, There was the story that they barely had 30%, let alone 70%. I don't know if that's 100% accurate, but from what I read, they barely had 30%. In fact, Amazon was challenging whether they had that at one point. And as someone who's done this stuff in the past, nowhere near the level that you have, I went by the 75% rule. You got to have at least 75% because you're going to get the bleed off from people who, you know, are intimidated and harassed through the captive audience meetings and the veiled threats of, well, you know, we might have to close down and move. And as crappy as this job is, you'd still lose this crappy job and you can't have that. So it gets people, you know, based on fear, and fear always works. So for me, you know, I didn't know that Alabama was the right place to choose this fight. So I guess the question that I have is, by getting the results I think we both agree were going to happen, does this put a chilling effect on the Teamsters who are trying to organize, the drivers, from what I'm told, from other unions who are trying to go after Amazon facilities in states that aren't right-to-work states?
I can't speak to that. I mean, I'm trying to get Kim Kelly, who was on the ground doing a lot of interviews with the workers, to do a conversation like this and maybe get it transcribed and published in these times. I genuinely can't speak to that, and I want to be really clear about that. And again, I'm 5 years out of active duty, and which makes me, you know, less willing to sort of backseat driver, you know, Monday morning quarterback union organizing decisions. I would say that, first of all, again, one of the things that this campaign reveals to the rest of the world is just like a boss can have like almost virtually 24-hour access to their workers to do this campaign of intimidation. And the union, like, has to be like 200 feet away from the curb, right? And that's what the bosses are counting on. Even before this, there were a lot of unions that had a strategy of like, yeah, go forward with a 30% petition, because the only time that you get access, the only contact information for the worker, that you get their names and home addresses, is after you file a petition and you get a union election scheduled.
Right.
And so a lot of unions had a strategy of just like, file the petition, and then the boss is going to commit a ULP, file the ULP, get the election blocked, but now at least you have their addresses and you can build from that. Again, that speaks to like the creativity that I think that we need to have going forward. You know, I used to run the AFT's Charter School Organizing Division, and I studied under Dr. Bronfenbrenner at UMass. She's a genius. Her work is unassailable. We followed the rules of her research. I took a lot of the stuff that I learned at the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union and brought it back over to the AFT. We're like, you would follow the rules of, you need to have a strong organizing committee. You need to be able to withstand the boss's organizing campaign. And we would spend $4 million a year organizing 1,000 workers. Because if you're following those rules, you wind up walking away from more campaigns than you wind up pulling the trigger on. Because that's how stacked the law is in the boss's favor.
And that's where I wanted to get to, because, you know, as you've said, you have to file this for an election to get the names and addresses of people. And in a place that has 100% turnover over the year, it's a constant fight to get the people who are going to be there. And yet, you know, the employer, they know who they're hiring and they know who they're firing. They have all the control. So the game is rigged even before you even started, which is why I've been saying that for decades we've needed comprehensive labor law reform. And it brings us to the PRO Act. Is there any chance of this remaining in the infrastructure bill so that the lessons we've learned from this Amazon campaign is something that you can move forward on?
I think there's genuinely a chance. I mean, it's still a fight. You know, Bernie's going to fight for it.
Right, because
he's in a pretty good position to do so.
Right. So this is a major loss. And all of the conditions of people, you know, defecating in bags and urinating in bottles because they can't take a break. You know, those stories are out there, and most people are, I can't believe that happens still, but it does.
No, I mean, that's the thing. And I would say this other about the devotion to the organizing model, in as much as the organizing model is predicated in this notion of nobody cares, nobody's going to have any sympathy for us. The labor movement has been suffering in silence for decades. And it really is about time that we really start highlighting just how outrageous what bosses can get away with.
No, and I had thought in this moment, coming out of this pandemic, out of all the things that we've had to endure over the last year, that now is this organizing opportunity that people are going to say, hey, I've had enough. We've eaten enough. You know what? It's time for us to take a stand. And I was, you know, there, like I said, guardedly optimistic that the workers at Amazon were going to say, you know what? We're treated like garbage here. We're constantly surveilled. They didn't do enough to protect us during COVID. We need a voice. Sadly, that didn't happen.
I mean, I don't really view that election as a genuine expression of worker voice. And you know, the election is going to get overturned. It's going to get rerun because Amazon broke the law in every way possible. You know, I mean, they created a company union.
Right.
Right. The whole story of the National Labor Relations Act getting passed is that there was a paper right to organize a union that was in the National Industrial Recovery Act. And, you know, Little Steel was shooting their workers in the street. And so a couple of like crusading senators were doing hearings on this. And one of them, Wagner, wound up drafting a new law to put some teeth into unfair labor practices. And I think that's actually what this has done. They're not shooting us yet, thankfully.
Not yet.
Hopefully it doesn't last much longer. But they're just egregiously violating the law and calling out to the ways that this needs to, you know, that there needs to be real teeth to here. And here's the thing, actually, there is a school of thought among labor lawyers, both pro-management and frankly pro-labor, that given that there's no financial penalties for just breaking the law, just, you know, firing somebody, you could fire somebody and all you got to do is rehire them and pay them whatever unemployment didn't pay them in the years that it took for them to
get a little slap on the wrist, post a notice.
You can threaten, you can lie, you can hire people to impersonate NLRB agents to lie to the workers about what their rights are. And this happens in 10% of all union elections. And you don't get a fine. There's no fine at all. Meanwhile, if there is a union contract, the boss is going to pay some more, you know, they're going to pay some more. So there's a school of thought among labor lawyers at this point that it's like, you're possibly committing malpractice if you don't advise your boss
to break the law.
To break the law.
Yeah. Which is, again, is why we need
a system. It's a totally broken system.
Totally broken. Why we need comprehensive labor law reform. But Sean, I appreciate the time. I'm sure you'll be back to explain more of this. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Good stuff. Sean Rickman, program director there at the Harry Van Ardsdale Junior School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.